Hello, men, and welcome to this week's episode of the weekly Life Study Podcast by Morningstar Fellowship Men's Ministry. And this week is going to sound sometimes a little bit more like a civics class than it is a Bible study slash life study. And you may be wondering if you got the wrong podcast, but you didn't. From time to time, we have to discuss some things that are relevant in society, and also at times we need to pause and consider the many benefits and blessings that we already have in this country. It's irresponsible to ignore some of the great benefits and blessings that we have and not give credit where credit is due, not acknowledge the special place that we have in time and history. And I think you're going to appreciate the freedoms that you have, the freedoms that we all enjoy, a little bit more if you follow along and listen to all of this podcast. So while it may seem a little bit tedious at times, and it may sound at times more like a classroom study than it is a informal teaching, just try to work along with it. And I think by the end, you'll definitely be blessed. You'll have some different understandings and appreciations for the value of freedom. And while we think it's such a commonplace thing, how rare it actually is. And we'll catch up with you again next week, men. Hope you have a great Fourth. So let's not be intimidated by the extensive nature of paper here. We're actually going to depart from the norm for a little bit today. I'm actually going to ask you to just follow along if you want to. If you don't like to follow along, you don't have to. I made copies of this first part excerpted from the book, The Miracle of Freedom, so that you would have it later to think about. As a matter of fact, to have it later not only to think about, but to in some way try to fashion a means that you could start to communicate these ideas to maybe children or grandchildren that you have. And you'll see why in a moment. So it really doesn't need any introduction, so let's just jump into it and begin reading. For those of us living in the United States, a nation that has experienced more than 200 years of unparalleled liberty, it is easy to take for granted the extraordinary gifts that we have been given. And for most of us, it is much easier to become lackadaisical about these gifts, that is for the inhabitants of other nations who are forced to struggle every day in their battle for liberty. In fact, unless we are serious students of world history, or we have traveled extensively, we might not recognize how unique the blessings of liberty actually are. Throughout the age of human experience, most people have never been afforded the simple right of the freedom to choose. So if you have a pen there, I'd like you to underline those two words separately. Freedom and choose. You'll see why later. The great exception to this truth is the modern age, by which we mean the years since the United States of America has been in existence. And even in this modern age, with the exception of the United States, freedom and democracy are not universal and have not been of long duration. These gifts are limited to those countries that we refer to as the West, meaning Europe and the United States, and those few nations scattered around the world that have emulated the Western form of political philosophy and government. Individual freedom is an idea that has been barely recognized for most of human history. True, there are a few examples of rare cultures or extraordinary leaders who at least tried to understand the value of freedom and justice, but they are few and far between. One example would be the ancient Babylonian king Hammurabi, who in 1790 BC put forward a code that would assure that the strong should not harm the weak. In the Jewish laws found in Leviticus, Jehovah tells the people, "Thou shalt not respect the person of the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty, but in righteousness shalt thou judge thy neighbor." Scattered examples of justice and acknowledgement of individual dignity aside, the fact remains that the majority of human beings have never even thought about the possibility of living under the protection of a government that would honor their individual rights or grant them freedoms. Which then raises a certain question. Are oppression, tyranny, and fear the natural order of things? Looking over the span of human history, the answer might seem to be undeniably yes. 19th century French philosopher Frédéric Bastiat argued in his short but powerful work, The Law, that is, it is injustice instead of justice that has an existence of its own. Justice is achieved only when injustice is absent. In Bastiat's view, injustice is the norm, the instinctive way of man. He claims that in order for justice to prevail, injustice must first be eliminated. And then I cut out a section, and then we're going to move on. And there's a few statistics in this next part that are pretty astounding. American Dr. Walter Williams made the following observation. Mankind's history is one of systematic, arbitrary abuse and control by the elite. It's a tragic history where hundreds of millions of unfortunate souls have been slaughtered, mostly by their own government. A historian writing 200 or 300 years from now might view the liberties that existed for a tiny portion of mankind's population, mostly in the Western world, and for only a tiny portion of its history, the last century or two, as a historical curiosity. Now, there's a lot of breaks in that sentence, but do you understand what he's saying? That if you were to look out across all of human history, that this is simply a blip right now that represents the unusual, not the common. That we live in a rare time. That historian might also observe that the curiosity was only a temporary phenomenon. Mankind reverted back to the traditional state of affairs. Arbitrary control and abuse. Another point worth pausing at. How much do we take our freedom for granted? Do we assume that it was and it is and it will be? Or do we view it as something rare that needs to be protected? To be nurtured and without certain conditions remaining in place that it could just as easily revert back to the state of chaos and abuse that's described for most of human history. For most of people throughout most of human history. William's point is hard to dismiss. This modern day we live in, with the unimaginable blessings of freedom and liberty, is the aberration, not the norm. Further, simply because freedom exists today does not guarantee that this gift will survive for future generations. How unusual is it, really, in the history of all known human experience, to enjoy the blessings of living free? What are the odds of being born in such a day? The best estimates of how many people have ever lived on the earth range from 100 to 110 billion. Just let that number settle in for a minute. That's a lot of people. Freedom House estimates that approximately 3 billion of the earth's current population live in free nations. Now, 3 billion sounds like a lot until you would put it in a chart next to 110 billion, at which point it looks like the period at the end of the sentence. Most of this is due to the fact that the number of free nations has almost doubled in the last generation. It has also been estimated that 544 million people have lived under the freedom of the United States since 1780. We can also postulate that perhaps another billion or fewer have lived under freedom in other European nations that evolved in fits and spurts into free nations during the 20th century. Even being generous in our estimates, it seems clear that fewer than 5 billion of the Earth's total inhabitants have ever lived under conditions that we could consider free. So that's 5 billion total stacked up against, we'll go on the low side and say 100 billion. This would be something like 4.5% of the people who have ever lived. And these are generous estimates. The actual numbers might be much lower than this, which is, as Dr. Williams said, truly a tiny portion of mankind's population. Even more surprising is the fact that freedom is a relatively unstable marvel. For example, in a recent work, Yale professor Robert Dahl could identify only, and this is staggering, only 22 nations with a democracy older than 50 years. Think about that. Even now, when most of us consider free will and self-government as the norm, there are only 22 nations that have lived under a democratic form of government for even a single lifetime. Most of the nations Dahl identified were European or English-speaking, with Costa Rica being the only Latin American country, Israel the only nation in the Middle East, and Japan the only nation in Asia. What do we mean by democracy and freedom? Any analysis of the rarity of freedom and democracy is complicated by the fact that the very definition of freedom is subjective, and that the term democracy has many meanings. So how do we define these salient terms? Perhaps we have to start at the beginning, that is, with what our founding fathers considered the fundamental truths that justified their rebellion. And just pause for a minute there. We know history so well that we take it for granted. What was the founding point of our freedom? It was revolution. In other words, it took armed force and a prolonged period of combat in order to secure for us freedom, and we should never forget that. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. Now that might be the most revolutionary phrase of all, and it comes after the part that we're most familiar with. So we'll read that one last time. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. All right, so let's roll the tape backwards about 300 years, and we'll interview what we'd call the man on the street. What would the man on the street's perception of government have been 300 or 400 years ago? Would we say that his perception would be that government existed to secure the rights and the benefits and the blessings of the individual, or something else? And not something better either. So even this statement is a profound observation that we've come to take for granted. And my suspicion is that most of us, myself included, maybe myself especially, go about our everyday affairs and we actually do not have any concept of how precious and how rare the ability to choose. The right to walk out of the house when you please. The right to drive up the street and get a cup of coffee or whatever. The fact that you actually have money in your pocket to go buy the cup of coffee. And so today we're going to look at what it takes for people to live free and what would undermine that. And that's why I said I think this might be, in a minimalist way, useful conversation to have with children. And it's a good discussion. I wish there were more of us here today. It's a good discussion because what I've become convinced of, having done the back work for this, is that unless a people learns how to live in freedom, they'll, over a period of generations, lose that freedom. That it takes knowledge, wisdom, and intent to preserve freedom. And exactly like that guy said, and do you remember what he said? That injustice is the natural state of affairs, not justice. And that freedom cannot prevail in a condition of injustice. So if injustice is the natural state of affairs, and if people do not know how to preserve justice, then it's just as probable that things will revert back to what they were. All right, so before we move on, what's freedom? Let's just see where we are, what your understandings, and I see y'all looking at your notes, which is not fair. The one time I want you not to look at your notes, and you're all staring at them. No, you didn't. You were busy opening, you were busy serving us, Scott.
But I have an answer. Correct answer, but Grant has an answer.
Yes, he does, and he's going to have the chance to give that answer now.
Having the ability to choose.
There we go.
That's the answer.
Does anybody want to add anything to that who hasn't looked at the notes?
Without consequence.
Without consequence? I'm going to put that up there and we're going to see if that's true. Anyone else want to add anything to it? Okay, let's take a look at the definition. Not my definition, incidentally. I thought this was a very suitable one. Freedom is the right and the capacity of people to determine their own actions in a community which is able to provide for the full development of human potentiality. All right, so let's break it down here. Freedom is the right and the capacity of people to determine their own actions. In light of those two statements, now let's refine the definition. Okay, so coming back to the statement above here, that people are granted certain unalienable rights. So we'll introduce that. But the definition is coupled to the other one. It says the right and the capacity. For those who are unable, someone else will. So there's an acknowledgement there that not all people are equally endowed with the power to choose in a way that preserves their freedom. We're going to look at two additional words. I don't want to rush ahead, but here's two words worth considering right now as we consider freedom. Theoretical freedom and practical freedom. There's a world of difference. And even in this country, there is theoretical freedom that doesn't have practical implications. We'll look at that.
I have some questions. The Miracle of Freedom, do you remember when that was published?
2011. It's a relatively new book. It's still in print. You can download it digitally. It's a superb book. Actually, that was the introduction. The authors are brothers, and they've written two books. This one focuses, actually, the main title, Seven Tipping Points. It focuses on seven unique occasions in history that the authors are convinced have made freedom a possibility and without which democratic government in a free society could have been impossible. They're like seven instances in history that had a war gone in a different way, had a people chosen in a different way at a certain time in the past, it's highly unlikely that what we enjoy today could have ever come about. So it's pretty fascinating. Well, anyway, what else do we see there? In a community which is able to provide for the full development of human potentiality. So the ability to choose, the capability to choose within, don't look at me, I mean it's there. The ability to choose, the capability to choose within
the environment.
Within an environment composed of more people. And so in that short definition, it addresses a couple of key things. That merely because I extend to you the right to choose doesn't mean that you know how to choose or know how to choose in ways that will not in future time encumber you. Just because you have the right to choose and even you have the ability to choose does not mean that if someone else within that community is stronger, that your right will be preserved. So it's a very concise but really pithy definition. It contains a lot of stuff. But it also speaks to certain things. It's interesting. People's desire to choose. Now, as much as the author suggested that injustice is the default state of humankind when they coexist, what do you suppose is the default state regarding choice? We almost always are, we seem born determined to choose, don't we? Why does a child cry? Because it has a desire. It wants something and it feels that it's entitled to the something. And so here is the paradox that we exist with. That it seems that the ability to choose, the freedom to choose, is very rare. But the desire to exert what we'll call self-destiny, or to be able to choose for yourself, is almost universally experienced. So what does it feel like to be the other 95 billion people in the world born with a desire to choose, but without the right to? Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, wouldn't this give a person pause for at least 30 seconds in the morning before they jumped in their car to go to work to say, maybe it really is a better day than I've made it out to be? So people's desire to choose. Their ability to choose well, the environment which makes choosing a real option, and complete with real consequences. And that's where I said we would put this up here, but But I think we're going to see in short order that without consequences, we really don't have choice that's meaningful. If you are protected from your own choices, if you choose badly and there is no consequence, if you choose in ways that will enslave you later or enslave others later and there is the consequences are erased, then was the choice meaningful? No. Choice is not meaningful unless and until you can experience the consequences of the choice. So consequence is to the human condition about the equivalent of pain to the human body. Does anybody want to add anything before we move on? Could you please reach over and smack him in firmly? I would encourage you to exercise your right to choice. Yes, you do have the freedom to do that.
But let me assure you, there will be a consequence.
All right. So just so that we're clear that this is not a complete break from what we've been looking at. Let's turn over to you. It's the beginning of your second page. Sorry. If wisdom is possessing both the knowledge and the desire to select a best course of action, and remember, that's what we've been looking at. Wisdom. How do we get it? How do we keep it? What is it? What are its implications in all areas of life? So, now that I've half read the definition for you, let's circle back and say, what is wisdom? What did you want me to do? We'll get there. Patience. Good things take time. Most bad things take time too, but we'll hope for the best right now. What is wisdom? We've used this definition now. This is the fourth week, so it will be depressing if somebody doesn't know this. And I don't want to have to ask Ron, who's right now enthusiastically reading the notes that I've asked him not to. Wisdom? Anybody?
Knowledge.
See, there's somebody else on the trigger. There they go.
It's knowledge and the common sense to apply it and to be able to make the best choice possible.
There was that second part, is the part that we're looking for. Wisdom is the ability to make the best choice in the broadest variety of circumstances. If wisdom is possessing both the knowledge and the desire to select the best course of action or attitude in the widest number of circumstances, then freedom is having the greatest number of options. And now you can see why these two are connected. So freedom without wisdom is a curse. We see that. And wisdom without freedom is a cruel joke. So what would be the purpose to cultivating wisdom if you had no authority to exert any influence? Do you understand what I'm saying? So wisdom really only has meaning in an environment where freedom exists to the point that I can exert the wisdom. Freedom makes wisdom useful and beneficial. We could even say that without freedom to choose and experience the consequences of having chosen, wisdom is of very little value. Wisdom then preserves and enhances the value of freedom and makes it a desirable condition. All right. So now we have to ask another question. So we say we have freedom. What exactly does that mean, not in textbook definition, but are there different kinds of freedom? And do they have to work together? Is it enough to have one kind of freedom and not another? And if we don't have certain kinds of freedom, is it possible to lose other kinds or they're meaningless? So I'm going to throw an illustration out for you. Well, let's just look, before we even do that, let's just go through this list here. This is a list I put together quickly, a collection of basic freedoms. Attitude and belief. In other words, I have the right to think and think in the way that I wish to think. Now that's a hard one to remove, isn't it? Because anybody can think the way they wish as long as they don't express the way they think. Even in the most rigid and confining of circumstances. Right? Your kids have the right to think the way they want to think, even when you're imposing martial law in the household, right? Or your grandchildren, in your case. Was any martial law imposed this week?
Absolutely.
It was. See, there you go. And they were, in their own minds, free to think that you were a despot and a tyrant.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? They were even free to experience the consequences of expressing that opinion, I'm sure. And what we inquiring minds really want to know is, are all five grandchildren still alive?
Absolutely.
Are they all well?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And so you did not exert heavy-handed tyranny. Now, it's a silly illustration, but you see what I'm saying. So it doesn't... What... Of what complete value is it to have the right to think fresh ideas if you're never afforded the opportunity to express them? And that's why I say that certain freedoms, although they are somewhat helpful, are very limited if they're not given other freedoms to accompany them. So attitude and belief, expression, travel and residence. That you might even think that that's silly. But you know, there's a lot of parts of the world where you can't just pack up and decide you're going to move to Oklahoma. Why anybody would want to move there, I'm not sure, but you couldn't. And vice versa, people could not. There, none of that exists, that you are set in a particular place, and without rare and rarely granted approvals, you're not given the right to move. Now, why does that matter? How does that help? How does that enhance the ability to travel and determine where you would like to live? How does that enhance your freedom? See, all these things come together and we take them for granted. No? Anyone? Okay, suppose it was your life's dream to be an Egyptian archaeologist and you were never granted the freedom to leave this country. Would that be tough? It would be almost impossible. All right, that was an easy, almost stupid example. But there are ways in which people feel a calling or a tug to a certain kind of expression. They would like to pursue a certain career. They have a particular interest in something. See, we say all the time that God gives people uniquely, right? Well, what would it be like to be one of the 95 billion people that have lived and feel that God has gifted you in certain ways and yet not possess the ability to follow through on that? All right, so a freedom of governance, and by that I mean the people's ability to govern themselves. That's a different kind of governance. And so here we'll say, suppose that Scott wants to leave and move to, where did I say? Was it Oklahoma? Okay, so suppose Scott wants to leave and move to Oklahoma, but John wants him to stay here because Scott works for John, and John finds it financially advantageous for Scott to continue working there. Now, in a free society, Scott can say, well, that's it, John, I quit. I no longer want to be in your employment. But in a less free society, John would simply say, I'm the Lord over this area, and you're my servant, and you're going to stay in my employment forever. The ability to govern ourselves and do it with justice is a unique thing. Incidentally, and this is one of the things that makes freedom possible. Actually, there's two things that I think make freedom possible. So if freedom is the goal, there's a certain environment in which it flourishes. The choice of a means to govern ourselves is one of those, and a financial system that allows us to take advantage fully of the fruit of our labor is the other one. So if I cannot accumulate any of the fruit of my labor, then it imposes a restriction on me that I'll never be able to be truly free. And this is where we started to talk about the distinction between theoretical freedom and practical freedom. So if I am so financially poor that I could not move to another area if I wanted to, if I am so financially poor that I could not do any of the things that I would like to, I could never buy property, I could never, then of what good is it to have the theoretical freedom? And that's why consequence is important. Because once I'm granted financial freedom, once I'm granted governance freedom, I still have to feel the consequences of my own choices. And if I am free to choose but not free to experience the consequences, who do I blame when I've chosen badly? Everybody else. It is only when the full weight of the choices that I've made can settle in on me that I can start to experience the full benefit of freedom and also appreciate wisdom. All right. Finally, the last one that I put down allegiance because I wanted to define it in the broadest of terms. We would call that the freedom to worship. The freedom to set as the highest power that we honor, whom we choose to set as that highest power. And that's the freedom to align ourselves with, to be allied to the thing that we choose to. We use that word a lot. I'd like us to connect freedom and purpose. Incidentally, if you didn't come here today looking for, we'll call it academic level material, I'm sorry, because this is just weighty stuff. I can't help it. If you wanted a light and easy course, you should have gone to, I don't know, Friday morning study group or something. Make me some connections between freedom and purpose.
If you have something you want to do, you've got to be able to have the freedom to go do it.
If you have something you... Okay. So a purpose without the freedom to move in that direction seems, again, cruel and twisted. Let's look at it from the other vantage point, though. What about freedom without purpose? Wander aimlessly. Go on. Okay. Let me tiptoe into a common phrase. What does the American dream mean? Okay.
Was that correct?
Privileges.
If you were to ask 100 people on the street, what does the American dream mean? Okay. Okay, well, Mr. Jefferson over there. What's your first name, Tom?
You get 100 different answers. Maybe you might not get any answers at all.
Okay. Now what about the difference between someone who has never tasted freedom and comes into it for the first time versus people who have been born into freedom and they've lived generations, we'll say, in freedom? They not only appreciate it more, they don't take it for granted, and they have clear purposes for which they use the freedom that they didn't previously have. In other words, they had a purpose before they had freedom, and so freedom means something because it is the means to allow them to pursue their purpose. But what happens when you have freedom but no purpose? Look out in society Think about this carefully. If you have purpose but no freedom, you have a hunger for the freedom because you want to pursue something that you feel is important. And to speak to what Jason said about an immigrant population, usually is their first purpose, once they acquire freedom, is their first purpose to buy a bigger car or a bigger house?
Education
that will allow them to care for themselves financially, set up their children better, and do all that. But what happens if you have been born with this and you haven't been given that? You become a directionless people and you employ your freedom for secondary purposes. And so the pursuit of happiness becomes more important than the pursuit of higher objectives. How long are you happy? How long am I happy? Let's just be honest. 5 minutes? 10 minutes if it's a good meal?
You have to be happy first before you put the time on the clock.
Huh?
First you have to be happy before you put the time on the clock.
Okay. If I were ever to be happy once in my life, can you tell me how long I might be that?
Nanosecond.
Huh?
Nanosecond.
Nanosecond. Okay. So when I don't have a big purpose, I settle for a secondary purpose, which is my immediate happiness. And I'm never fulfilled. And I'm always out after something else. What happens when we make happiness our highest objective? Has anyone that you know ever impeded on your personal happiness? Besides your wife. You're not laughing at this at all.
Not his wife. I think our country is in a serious state of this. Last Friday has embellished a lot of it, but it also embellishes where the church has fallen down, identifying sin and being willing to deal with our own crap versus pushing our purpose against other people's freedoms. So it's not that I'm sucking it all in. This is a sermon later in life that I'll preach to a mirror.
I want you to think, because he's at a large scale talking about that very thing. Okay, so let me give you what I wrote over here. Wisdom is exercising freedom that preserves the most freedom for the most people with a goal in mind. With a goal in mind. And so this reverts back to self-governance. The most freedom for the most people I'm going to introduce a third one that I didn't put there. For the most time. Suppose that you and I took a different attitude toward life, and instead of saying that freedom was something that others needed to procure for us and secure for us, that we personally were each responsible, at least in part, for attaining and preserving freedom. In other words, suppose the cultivation of freedom was each individual's responsibility. And that our mission in life, throughout the entirety of our life, was to live our lives in ways that would avail for the most people, the most freedom, for the most time. And after all, there are people who have dedicated their lives to that premise. As a matter of fact, public service, what we would call getting into some sort of government affairs, is generally, ideally, supposed to be about that, right? To preserve the most freedom for the most people, for the most time. It's this last part that I want to focus on. Because that's the part that the fewest of us actually think about. Most of us are focused about the most freedom for the most people right here and now. Here's the question. Is it possible that by availing people more freedom, more personal freedom today, we impose a cost on future generations? And so that in the pursuit of the most freedom today, we actually deprive future generations of the possibility of the most freedom that they can have. And so then it becomes irresponsible to seek personal freedom in the moment that may deprive future generations of the same thing that we cherish. Just let that settle in for a minute, because that's big. Now let's come back to your issue. Not your issue, but the issue that you raised. Do you see any implications there?
Absolutely.
Bring me some of that.
I've seen it historically. Part of the Greek, I think it was called the dynasty empire. The Greek Empire, Roman Empires walked the same steps that we're taking prior to their demise.
Excuse me, my brother Scott forgot to get me any coffee, so I'm going to have to get my own over here.
He's thinking about moving to Oklahoma. We get stuck in the idea that freedom is the goal, where we need some sense of boundaries. Freedom isn't the goal. Freedom is a means of reaching the goal.
Did you hear what he said? Because that's the essence of what we're talking about. So for most people, they believe that freedom to choose is the ultimate goal, but freedom to choose is only a vehicle that we drive to the destination that we want. Turn over to the back side of your second page. Remember what we just said. Freedom is the vehicle that we drive to the destination that we want. Division in values, which destroys real unity and turns people against each other. This is one of the things that divides and reduces our probability of freedom. We no longer agree on what is good, what is right, what is best, and we cannot find common ground. When people cannot agree about the most basic of values and are not willing to demonstrate respect for and tolerance for each other's basic freedoms, then conflict is inevitable. The nature, the extent, and the duration of the conflict are themselves functions of values, either shared or disparate. So here's the nutshell version of this. When you and I disagree strongly about something, and we cannot respect each other's right to choose in a certain way, or when your choice to believe your way is going to put my ability to choose in peril, then what happens? There's only a couple of options.
You've got conflict. Definitely got conflict.
There is either conflict, or the rights of one group of people are progressively stripped away until the point that they really have no rights anymore. And they become a subservient class to the class that is now acquiring what they want. Now, in case you think that we're too sophisticated for that to occur in this country, does anything dispute that assumption?
Yeah, professional athletes.
What?
I'm just throwing out some skills. For example, professional athletes gets arrested for illegal substance abuse. They get a slap in the hand, they go back to their $1 million job. Other people, they go to jail. That's their punishment. So there's an injustice based on who you are. And the same wrongdoing is treated differently.
Hence, we're not really equal under the law. Okay, and when we are not equal under the law, turmoil starts to churn below the surface. Yes?
That's a perfect example, I think, of what you're talking about in the news recently. There's a guy who makes cakes or something, has a business, worked hard, made a lot of money, and lived the American dream. And a gay couple came in and wanted their wedding done by this guy. He didn't agree. He believed differently. He didn't believe that was right.
Right.
Two guys married. So he said, listen, I'll serve you. You can be in my store, I'll serve you, but I'm not going to participate in your wedding event because they wanted him to do that. They ended up suing him. Mm-hmm. They're now thinking, taking away his freedom
sure.
in front of the business because he's going to lose a lot of money fighting them.
There was another company that closed the business for a lesbian couple. They just got sued and awarded through a court system $75,000 to the lady who actually came and asked for the lesbian cake to be made, and $60,000 for her girlfriend, which put their business under.
Okay, these are current events. But these are not the only times that our country has been divided. I want you to understand, we're only a few generations removed from a civil war. We literally did kill each other over our beliefs. So when we look out across the world and we say, why can't people just live peacefully with each other? The reality is that this freedom that we enjoy really is less stable, more volatile, and more fragile than we like to give it credit for. And so as much as it sounds completely absurd, if you think about the passion with which we believe certain things to be right or wrong and can't agree on them in this country, you can see that it's possible that two or three generations out, it's not inconceivable that we could come to blows with each other. It's not as if there are all peaceful demonstrations in the street, right? Even when human beings come together in a street protest, there can be conflict.
We have so much freedom.
Way down the front side of your second page. I'm sorry, I should have numbered these. Okay, thanks Scott for affirming my capabilities. I always appreciate having you around. Alright, right below that list, it starts with attitude and expression and travel and all that, which was the list of the different types of freedoms. Personal liberty requires individual discipline. Choice is made possible through freedom. Restraint by the individual makes freedom for the many possible. Individual freedoms must be made subject to public good. Now just stop right there. What was just said there?
Oh, I have freedom to buy a gun, but it doesn't mean I can shoot people with it.
Right.
That's taking away all my freedom.
Exactly. So in every situation, a responsible person has to ask, does the exercise of my freedom inhibit the freedom of someone else? Now, it's inevitable, right, that there's going to be that. If there was only one person in the world, then that person could live wherever he wanted, have whatever he wanted, use whatever he wanted, unencumbered. As soon as there's two people in the world, what happens?
Yeah, there's an impending conflict. You're on my side.
Huh?
You're on my side.
Well, I will be on your side until I want to live where you're living. And
you're living on my side of the land.
Oh.
You touched me.
That kind of, yes. So you're like two kids in the back seat of the car on your way to vacation. Now what happens when there are 7 billion or 8 billion of us that all share the same world? See, and I want us to understand this. It is not just our side, everyone. Everyone. See, we tend to make things about sides. It's not only our side. Every one of us has to understand we don't all think the same way. We don't all believe the same things. As difficult as this is, we have to learn how to live with the greatest amount of tolerance and acceptance that we can without that tolerance and acceptance infringing on the rights of others. And this is a real delicate balance. That brings us to the next component of what it takes for freedom to be enduring freedom rather than temporary. What happens when your values and my values collide? You said, why can't we treat each other? What happens when your values and my values collide? So we'll come back to the example that Vinny used. It's kind of a hot button topic, admittedly, but we can tease some good stuff out of this. Now, the problem with, if you can permit me a little bit of leash here, the problem with the way that the conservative side approached this was they really didn't have many solid arguments, and they didn't really have many great spokespeople. We were intellectually outgunned by the side that was championing marriage equality. So Jim and I have great discussions at the diner. It's a lively time whenever we meet. So I posed this to Jim the other night, because this apparently Saturday mornings are not the only time we talk about things like this. So I posed this question to Jim the other night. What's marriage? Before we talk about marriage equality, and remember, this is only one example of how freedoms can be impinged on. Before we talk about marriage equality, shouldn't we define marriage? Because if we can't define marriage, how do we know what marriage equality is? Now, how many definitions of marriage have you seen flaunted about in public? If we're going to have a discussion on marriage equality, shouldn't we be able to at least be able to arrive at a baseline determination of what marriage is, so we can determine then if people are equal in their ability to marry?
Isn't it the church's own hypocrisy that has played part of that poor definition? And that we say we abide by these certain rules, and yet we don't. Our own ideas of marriage. How many times have you heard folks who profess to be Christians and were living with a girlfriend? I was one of them. How many of us who profess to be Christians have children outside of marriage? I was one of them.
Okay, so we all have part, a share in some of this dilemma, is what you're saying. That we've all not exercised our right to choose well, and in not exercising our right to choose well, we have in some ways encumbered the ability of future generations to live free. Let me sum it up in a different way that sounds a little bit more spiritually. My sin today puts a limit on someone else's freedom in the future.
Wow.
And we don't think of it that way. And the future isn't necessarily just 3 years from now. The future might be three generations from now. And with that in mind, you can see why this is such a precious and rare commodity that so few people across all time and history have enjoyed. So what's the first question about personal liberty that's usually asked? If I want to engage in some reckless behavior, what's the immediate justification? What's the go-to, the default justification for that? It's not hurting anyone. In other words, who's going to be affected? And the answer to that question is, well, my reckless behavior isn't hurting anyone else, so I should be free to engage in it. Right? Is that true?
No.
Here's a better question to ask. In addition to who might be hurt by the exercise of my personal freedom, the other question is, who will be helped by the exercise of my personal freedom? Because remember, if each of us is a steward of tomorrow's freedom, then we need to be concerned about more than exercising our personal freedom in the moment. So the better question isn't, who will be hurt by what I do, but rather, who will be helped by what I do?
It's not exactly what you're talking about.
Is it going to have to do with professional football players again? Okay.
I mean, you're talking about... I wasn't signaling anybody out. I mean, you talked about purpose and freedom to pursue it. It's having purpose and having the ability to pursue it. And now you're talking about, is your sin going to affect somebody else's? In a positive way. Let's say your wrongdoing now has a positive effect on somebody else. Perfect case in point. With the union of same-sex marriages...
We really are latched onto that one, aren't we?
With the union of same-sex marriages, if heterosexual marriage is 50% in divorce, same-sex marriage is 50% in divorce, divorce lawyers are now going to benefit by this sin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying, you're saying, now as a wrongdoing have benefits, it does to a lawyer. Their business is going to increase because of this.
Which is why, and this is a topic for a different day's discussion, but this is why whenever someone seeks to bring good to a bad situation, they meet resistance. Because every situation is the way it is, not only because certain people have enslaved themselves to it, but also because other people benefit by it. See, people wouldn't long remain addicted to drugs if there weren't people who benefited from the addiction. So for every act of unrighteousness, there are people who suffer the consequence and there are those who reap the reward.
Every action is a reaction, whether it's good or bad.
Sounds like something we said here before.
Sounds like something the philosopher said.
Okay. Another thing that we've talked about before, but I want to double down on again, is that unless I have, with freedom, unless I have the right to experience the full consequences of what I've sown, then the country or the entity in which I reside can't truly be free. Because if someone... Okay, so you have your 5 grandchildren for the week, and one of them does something wrong. One of them breaks the car window or does this or that or the other thing. Now, as an adult, if you break the window in your car, who's responsible to fix it?
Yeah, me.
Okay.
My grandkids.
Now, if your grandchild breaks the car window, who's responsible to fix it?
Same.
Right. And so what happens when we divorce consequences from actions? Someone else is encumbered with the responsibility to make good on the damage.
Sure. Absolutely. I'll give you a perfect example.
Uh-oh, now I hit a button.
Well, and it's not going to be professional athlete.
Good.
Because he really botched that. We're here in Bucks County. Our insurance rates for our cars are still considered higher because we're paying for some of these idiots in Philadelphia that will not get car insurance. My insurance company told me that. I think you have to get into Northampton County before you're actually unencumbered from the Philadelphia insurance rates, which is absolutely just nuts. So we're paying for other people's screw-ups.
Okay. Scott, would you make sure that the harness around his neck is strong enough? Because if he breaks loose, I'm afraid he's going to bite something. Yes, you can.
I just moved from Philadelphia, and the insurance rate in Philadelphia is much higher. I mean, when I moved here, it went down tremendously. My insurance.
Right. But it can still be low.
It can be higher. You know what I mean? Because of the lot of insurance.
Yes, true.
But I saw a great drop in the rate. And that was very good.
So, would you really say, Greg, as you learned how to drive in Philly?
Say that again.
Would you really say to learn how to drive in Philly?
Well, no, I'm just commenting on what you said. And it's probably true. It's more likely to be true. But I saw a drop right from here. You know, I mean,
right.
Why is it paid for cars?
It makes you have to get paid for it, and your insurance rates go up. We're going to the weeds now.
You think? We weren't happy. Yeah, well, it's too late. My line broke, buddy, so I can't reel it back in. So, back to civics 101 here. So, at least 2 systems that we need to put into place if we're going to continue to live free. We need a system of governance. We need an economic system. Because without the two, in place, and you'll see when you look at our country, what's our economic system? Well, what's our economic system? Come on. We call it capitalism. Okay? Now, as dirty a word as it is, and capitalism gets a lot of bad, has a bad reputation at times. Capitalism's bad reputation at times it deserves, because capitalism untempered leads to a lot of bad stuff. But if we do not have a system that allows people to harvest the fruits of their own labor, what do we call that? And that's the way most of the world lived, incidentally. Do you realize that up until about the 1600s, private property was an almost unheard of concept throughout all of Europe, what we call Europe today? Just wasn't heard of. You were born into a feudal system where you worked the land for somebody else who owned the land. So not only was an economic system lacking, there wasn't even such a thing as a concept of private property. Before we leave for the morning, we're going to read some scripture that is incredibly forward-thinking and insightful, that most people don't look at that way. So unless we have an economic system that allows us to be free to harvest the fruits of our own labor, we're not truly free. Unless we have a system of government that preserves our right to choose and protects the other people from the consequences of my choice, not myself from the consequences of my choice, but tries to protect other people from the consequences of bad choices on my part, then freedom erodes. So these two things, in the right measure, in the right way, must be in place, or there's what we'll call a theoretical freedom, but not practical implication to the freedom. So what happens when people are trapped at the lower end of an economic system and they can't escape it? What happens when I have the freedom to get an education, but I have none of the economic means to get it? I don't get it, and therefore, where do I stay in that system? Right. Now, we're not talking about revamping things into some sort of a socialist thing, but whenever we look at things, we generally point to another faction and say, they're misguided and they're going to steal freedoms from us. I think we need to look into our own hearts and say, are the things that I'm thinking, the ways that I'm believing, the actions that I would like to take on behalf of freedom, are they going to destroy freedoms for future generations? Remember the things that we talked about, the most freedom for the most people for the longest time period. And if you don't take that time period into account, we're very short-sighted about the way that we exercise governance and how we look at economic systems. As a matter of fact, let's turn over to that text right now. Does anybody have any comments while we're turning to Exodus 20? Now, I want to push back on that. There's nothing inaccurate about what you said. But I want to push back on this. Remember who we established. Who is responsible for preserving and protecting freedom?
We are.
We are. We cannot blame anyone else. We are responsible for protecting and preserving freedom. What kind of government do we have? We have a representative republic. What does that mean in practical terms in the 21st century? Okay, but here's what else it means. Because when we say it that way, it means, well, I just elect the right officials. Here's what it really means. And this is going to make every one of us feel a little uncomfortable. Here's what it means. In the past, when our country was founded, people gave up their livings in order to go for a period of time to serve in public governance. All right? And when that time was done, they went home. It was considered a sacrifice. It was considered very difficult. Not everybody wanted to do it for any length of time. As a matter of fact, most of the early political leaders were more than happy to return to their farms and the lives that they had enjoyed before that. Now, here's the thing. You know what we do today? And this is what I said is going to make us very uncomfortable. We hire people to go do the work that we don't really want to take off to go do. And we say, you go there and you lead us and you make the decisions for us. And then we grumble when they don't make the right decisions. Now, I ask you a different question. How would you like to take 6 months off and go to Washington and serve? See, most of us don't want to do that. Most of us would rather sit and grumble about the decisions that the people we've hired make. Well, now, if we run a business and the people that we hire to make the decisions don't make the decisions that we'd like, whose responsibility is it ultimately? Is it the hired guy? No, it's not. That's the essence of freedom. And the lie that we've been told is that it's really not our fault, it's not really our responsibility, it's their responsibility, and we're powerless to change this. And the lie is perpetuated by those who want to be hired. Right? It's a long interview process. It's a very long interview process. Those who want to be the top leader in our country have an extremely long interview process. It takes about a year. As a matter of fact, it's kicking off now. Right? And what do they do during the interview process? Yes, they do. But I don't want to say it in a destructive way. They make appealing promises. Again, Jim and I ventured into that territory the other night. They make appealing promises that they have no capability to make good on. Now I ask you, who's worse? The person who tells the lie or the person who believes the lie? Think about that. Who is at fault? Remember, they're interviewing for the job. We're the people who hire. They want a job. And so they've come and said, this is my resume, this is how I propose to do things, and what do we say? We cheer because they promise us things that we want, and we know they can't deliver on them. Or we should know. But most people don't know. And this is why we said that in order for freedom to be preserved, we must be willing to self-discipline, but we must become knowledgeable.
And we have to know who's lying the least to know who's
missing. Wow, that's a very unsettling concept, isn't it? Well, but here is, can I not discern that? When a man starts to make promises, or a woman, make promises about our fiscal future that they're not in a position to make good on, aren't they lying? It's not hard. I don't care if you lied 90% or whether you lied 80%. You either live in a world of delusion that suggests that you actually think you can make good on that, or you're just devious and you're lying to the people and you know you can't make good on it. But either way, there's something wrong. But when we buy into the lie, we're guilty. Freedom cannot exist long in an ignorant populace, because an ignorant populace can be lied to sufficiently so as their freedoms can gradually be stripped away. I'm sorry, this has turned more into Civics 101 than I had intended for it to be. All right, are we at Exodus 20? Incidentally, we call this life study because it's the convergence of the lives that we have to live with scriptural information and spiritual insights that can help us to do that better. That's why we don't do a Bible study. Because a Bible study just looks at the Bible, but we have real lives to live, and so what we're going to look at next is the convergence of real life with and an application of the scripture. Most of us have read or been exposed to the Ten Commandments since we've been little kids. Perhaps you've never looked at it this way, but I would like you now to look at this as commandments being given to a nation of slaves. They have spent generations of their lives being slaves. They have been under the domination of a leader who has sought to build an economic system that harvested their labor for his benefit and stripped them of the ability to lead themselves. The two things that are necessary before freedom can go away. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Now that's an interesting introduction. Why start there?
No more slaves. They're on their own. Now they have a little bit of freedom, as opposed to being under the rule of Pharaoh, and start a new life.
Don't take this opening line for granted as the preliminaries to the important speech that's about to come, but really take this seriously. What has been the experience of most... Remember what we read, how we opened this up. What has been the experience of most of the billions of people that have lived? What did their leaders come to tell them?
You're mine.
In a nutshell, right? Yes, that's exactly it. You are mine. You belong to me. The output of your life's work belongs to me. The members of your household belong to me. The children that you will produce, they all belong to me. And that really is the message that most people had been accustomed to hearing for all their lives. They might not have been exposed to it so brazenly. It might have been a little bit more subtle, but that was the message. When God says this, this is profoundly revolutionary. I am the leader, the strong individual that has come to deliver you out of slavery, not to put you in a new form of bondage. That's a different paraphrase that we might apply to that. And so you shall have no other gods before me. Well, why?
Because if you do, you'll be a slave.
You will, in short order, be back in slavery again. If you want to live free, trust me that I can make it possible for you to have the greatest probability of the most freedom for the most people for the most time. That's a very different approach. Now remember, whose idea was choice? Of course it was. Our birthright is choice. Choice apart from freedom is impossible. And therefore, God is coming to make good on what no other leader has been able to do. He is saying, I have come to allow you to exercise the birthright that has been given to you since the dawn of humankind. You shall not make for yourself carved images or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on the earth beneath, or in the waters underneath. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. All right, now, all that sounds a little weird. Where did they come from? They're slaves. They just come out of Egypt. Everywhere you would have looked in Egypt, you would have seen various gods. You would have seen the images of various gods. You would have seen priests that were serving the various gods. And so he's just reminding them, do not become enslaved to what is false, or you won't be able to soon tell the difference between what is false and what is real. And incidentally, he's just demonstrated his power over all those gods with all the miracles that become the process through which they're liberated. So he has just demonstrated his power, and so he said, I am a great and powerful leader. I'm a more powerful leader than all the leaders that were in Egypt that enslaved you. Why is that important? Come on, think about that. Why is that important to know that he is a great and powerful God? Anybody? Okay. Here's why. What happens in war when you choose to serve the king on the losing side? Huh? You're dead, and you're not only dead, you're dead in a very painful way. You may be hauled away into slavery and your life is gradually used up in serving the winning king. In other words, you'd better choose carefully whose side you're on before the battle starts, because if you pick the wrong leader and it's the weak leader, what happens? You're dead. God is clearly communicating to his people, I was powerful enough to liberate you. I am powerful enough to keep you free if you choose to serve me. But even from the beginning, he's availing them of choice. But you don't have to serve me. That's your choice. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. What are your thoughts on that? In light of all of this, don't be so casual with my name, so casual with tossing it about, that you don't understand who you're dealing with. I care about you. I've come to liberate you, but I am still a great king. Don't ever lose sight of that. Don't ever forget that. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Now, hasn't this been a source of frustration and contestation for most of church history? What does it mean to keep the Sabbath holy? And debates go back and forth. I remember when I was growing up, people would argue about whether it was really okay to mow the lawn on Sunday, whether the noise of the lawnmower was appropriate, whether that was work or whether it wasn't work. In some southern cultures in our country, kids couldn't even play on the Sabbath, because on Sunday, which they considered the Sabbath, because that was somehow an unholy use of the time.
And no stores were open on Sunday.
So no commerce could occur. You are a people of slaves. You are a country of slaves, and you have just been liberated. How many days a week does a slave work? How much choice does he have in that? That's right. Do you suppose that there was a great argument the day that this law was instituted saying, oh, come on, we wanted to go back and work 7 days a week? Now, it's true that there are people who remember the story the other week that we read about the guy who goes out to gather sticks and he ends up being stoned. Because what is our tendency? Our tendency, even when given the opportunity to have rest, freedom from work, that's what rest is. Freedom from work. Now, why do people work 7 days a week? To get ahead of the guy who works 6 days a week, and because they're afraid that they can't care for themselves if they don't work 7 days a week. So again, do you remember the difference between theoretical freedom and practical freedom? It would be a cruel joke to say, I want you not to work 6 days a week, but make it impossible for a person to survive unless they work 7 days a week. That wouldn't be freedom. That would be oppression. And so what God is saying is, I am not only going to give you, and incidentally, everyone who is in your house, including the animals and everything else, a day that you don't have to work, but you can also count on the fact that if you follow this constitution that I'm setting up for you, I'll provide for you. Not a handout, but I'll make sure that it is possible for you to live on the output of 6 days of labor and not seven. Do you think that would be a blessing to people? And there wasn't, just for cross-application to modern society, just to put you all at ease. What did a slave do? Physical work mostly, right? Hard physical work, and for who? For somebody else. So when God institutes a Sabbath, it is a time for rest and refreshment. It is a time for reflection and fellowship with God. But it's a time for the body to rest. We do things in a very different way today. So we might need rest from different things. But we still need time to realign with God, to pause, to give thanks for what we have. We need time to fellowship with God. We need some of that, but we need the rest in different ways. So I'm not encouraging you to be rigid and legalistic about your application of work on the Sabbath. I'm encouraging you to understand what these people heard, the first people to hear these commands, and what went through their minds when they heard those commands as slaves to physical labor. Honor your father and mother, that your days may be long in the land that your God has given you. How do I hear that in first century? I'm sorry, pre-first century. Who was the most valuable slave? If you had to pick the slave, there's 1,000 people on the auction block, and you're going to be the highest bidder, and you get to pick the one of those 1,000 people that you want. Who do you want? The biggest, the strongest, the one that's going to do the most work,
and the youngest.
And the youngest. And so who is of least value in a slave culture?
Old man.
Well, I'm sorry, old timer. Would you like us to get a cane for you? The old have no value anymore. Their use to their leader is done. They can't work themselves, and they can no longer produce. They're old, right? The likelihood of them having children is nil. See, at least if you could sire or you could bear more children, then at least the leader of the land gets more free labor for the future. When you can't work yourself and you can't produce people that do, what's your value in that culture? It's none. And so what God does is seek to protect that value. You are more than the work that you can do, is the message of that command. You shall not murder. Well, we get that. We get that, but interestingly, in a barbaristic society, what was the value of life? Pretty minimal. Was murder really a big deal? Life was pretty cheap. Life was pretty common. And so when God says, don't murder, He's putting a value on human life. All human life. You shall not commit adultery. We look at that differently today. Try to think of yourself as a slave. You shall not commit adultery. What did that mean? Why would that have had special significance to them? It's a loyalty thing. It's a power thing. When the noble class was not satisfied by the women in their stable, where did they go? They went to anyone that they could go to. And when you're of the noble class, you have the power to go to anyone that you want to and avail yourself of their services, whether they want to be availed of them or not. And so in this, it makes marriage a sacred bond, and it also makes violating that something that in their minds, it would remind them of their overlords. Don't lord this over my household like that by you coming in and taking advantage of me. That makes you like an Egyptian. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And now we're moving into some very personal stuff. If you want your society to last, how do people get their way when they aren't strong enough to get their way? Manipulation and lies and cheating. That's what's happening here. He says, if you're not strong enough to get your way, don't erode freedom by lying to try to get your way. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or make male servants, or his male servants, or his female servants, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. Final command. Why is that important? What is covetousness? It's an encumbrance. It's a slavery. I'm not happy with what I have. I cannot live in contentment. What good is freedom if you can't enjoy it? What good is freedom if the whole time that you're free, you're thinking about what you don't have and you really need to have before you can be happy? Right? Haven't we all been there? In one way or another, sure. And what he's saying is, if you want to enjoy this freedom, this is like the final rule, if you want to enjoy the freedom that I have purchased for you, then you need to learn to live content. After all, they came out of a culture where there was never a contentedness. One pyramid wasn't enough, let's make another. One temple wasn't enough, let's make another. One wife wasn't enough. Whew, what a concept that is. Let's have two. I don't understand that one. Do you see what I'm saying? This was actually not a command to inhibit their freedom. This was a command that would allow them for the first time to actually think about enjoying their freedom.